Democracy Now! Crew here on the ground in Madrid. Libby Rainey, Carla Wills, Nermeen Sheikh, John Hamilton, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Laura Gaddis, Dina Maria Terracena, Julia Thomas, Adriano Contreras, Dennis Moynihan, and Maria Carrion. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. Welcome back. And to Miriam Barnard. And a very welcome to the world to Maliki. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Join Kay Boo by December 31st and receive free gifts and prizes from the Give Guide. Just click the donate banner on the Kay Boo app to keep community radio strong and vibrant in Portland and beyond.
KBOO is having our annual book and record sale Saturday, December 21st from 12 to 10 p.m. There's a special member-only preview hour from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. The sale will be located at Jupiter Next in the Arium Ballroom at 900 East Burnside Street. KBOO is currently accepting donations of used and good condition books, records, CDs, and cassette tapes. KBOO is hosting sorting parties for this event on Friday, December 6th and Friday, December 13th at 5 to 7 p.m. at KBOO's 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. If you're able to help with sorting or help on the day of the sale, please contact volunteer at kboo.org. We hope to see y'all there.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the 5 o'clock news. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Gene Johnson, principal broker in Oregon with Riverside Global Realty, LLC. For more information on local real estate solutions, go to johnsonhousepdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Workers at the Grand Central Bakery production facility successfully unionize.
New petitions to increase regulation on semi-automatic weapons reach the state election board.
And in national news, the Supreme Court will hear the case on the president's tax returns.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 13th, 2019. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Claire Rosciato. Bakers and dishwashers at Grand Central Bakery's production facility have successfully unionized. After a vote last night, a majority of workers elected to join the Bakers, Confectioners, Tobacco Workers, and Grand Millers Union, Local 114. This will allow the workers to advocate for better wages and working conditions. The push for unionization was inspired by understaffing issues, how sexual harassment complaints were dealt with, the high rate of injuries on the job, and the need for better pay and benefits. For example, unionized workers at Fran's Bakery make $25 an hour with benefits, while Grand Central workers make only $18. Attempts to unionize had been stalled when management refused to accept cards from workers which stated they wanted to unionize. The owners also allegedly sent out anti-union letters to the bakers and dishwashers and forced them to attend anti-union meetings. The union also picked slogan, Unidos negociamos, divididos rogamos, meaning united we bargain, divided we beg. A press release announcing the union's formation stated, quote, we picked the slogan because it's the truth. Collective bargaining is how we make real gains in the workplace and how we improve our lives. Our coming together as BCTGM Local 114 is how we make this happen.
Three Portland area religious leaders have filed petitions with the State Election Division to increase restrictions on the sale of semi-automatic weapons. The petitions were filed by Rabbi Michael Kahana, Pastor Walter Knutson, and Reverend Alcina Boozer, a former principal at Jefferson High School. In order for the measures to make it onto the ballot for the 2020 election, they need 112,000 signatures this spring. The petition calls for the regulation of semi-automatic firearms and large-capacity ammunition magazines. There are a few different regulatory tactics in the petitions. One details how those regulations would be put in place, namely by increasing the minimum purchasing age to 21. Another would prohibit the sale of large-capacity magazines, which allow the holder of the weapon to shoot hundreds of bullets without needing to reload. The measures would also institute a specialized training course, a waiting period, and a successful background check completion before someone can purchase a semi-automatic weapon. Rabbi Kahana told Willamette Week about their effort, quote, "I think this is what makes our group unique. It's religious leaders who are taking leadership of this from a variety of religious traditions. We're united in the sense that what the biblical text teaches is that we can't stand idly by while our neighborhood bleeds."
The Supreme Court agreed today to hear the case on President Trump's taxes. Trump's team appealed the lower court ruling that would require his banks and accountants to turn over years of financial records to the House and to local prosecutors in New York. The case has the potential to have a major ruling on the power of the House and to demand records for investigation and for the president to resist them. By granting appeal, it means that the case will be heard in the current court term, and a judgment will be rendered by the end of June, in the midst of the general election campaign. One subpoena in question is from Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance, seeking a decade's worth of financial documentation for an investigation of hush money payments to women who allege they had affairs with Trump. Another is from the House Oversight Committee, who is investigating claims made by former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen, who said that Trump inflated his total assets when it served his purpose and deflated them in order to reduce his real estate taxes. Two other House committee subpoenas will be in question as well, looking into money laundering relationships with two banks and what leverage foreign actors may have had over Trump and his businesses. Trump's lawyers argue the subpoenas are beyond Congress's authority to issue, and while Democrats say they are confident that the court will uphold Congress's right to oversight.
The man shot by police Sunday is revealed to have suffered from mental illness, and according to Portland Police Chief Daniel Outlaw, his death highlights the failures of the mental health system in the county and puts officers in an impossible situation. Coben Henriksen was killed by Portland police on Sunday near 103rd Avenue and Stark Street after reportedly walking in traffic and waving a knife at passing cars. According to interviews with Henriksen's father, he may have been trying to get police to fatally shoot him. Henriksen had two earlier encounters with police this year, both of which were resolved peacefully. But his father says that his son has been suicidal for about 6 months because of an unspecified mental illness. According to a recent audit, Multnomah County struggles to deliver mental health services to people with serious and persistent mental illness. Fewer than half the people who could use intensive mental health services actually get it. The county suffers from rising housing costs and too few residential treatment facilities and housing programs.
The Oak Ridge School District has the fifth highest poverty rate in the nation among districts with at least 100 students. According to the Census Bureau, 56% of the school-age population lives below the poverty line. Five other Oregon school districts, including Klamath Falls and Ontario, also rank in the top 10% for child poverty in the nation. In Oak Ridge, the median household income is $34,000, about $20,000 less than the statewide average. At the other end of the spectrum, school districts like Sherwood, Lake Oswego, Riverdale, Banks, and Westland, Wilsonville rank in the top 10% of districts with the lowest rates of school-age poverty. The estimates were based on data from the Census Bureau, the IRS, and food stamp applications, and is part of an annual breakdown by the Bureau called Small Area Income and Poverty Estimates Program.
The Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources approved a bill to protect valuable southwestern Oregon landscapes. Eric Tegahoff has the story.
These plants have adapted to a lack of nutrients, and so there's more rare and endangered.
A bill to protect unique Oregon landscapes has made it through a key congressional committee. Introduced by Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley, the Oregon Recreation Enhancement Act would extend safeguards for the Rogue River and create protections surrounding the Malala River in Clackamas County and rivers in southwestern Oregon. Pam Marsh, a state representative from Ashland, says these protections have been pending for years, and the Rogue River area is an important recreational hub.
This will provide protections on lands that Oregonians treasure. And so to have those in perpetuity and to really recognize the irreplaceable value of those landscapes is a tremendous step forward.
The measure advanced out of the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources on Thursday. It would create a 30,000-acre recreation area near the Molalla River, establish the 98,000-acre Rogue Canyon Recreation Area, and expand the existing Wild Rogue Wilderness Area by 60,000 acres. It also would ban mining near 100,000 acres of the Calmeopsis Wilderness Area. Zach Collier owns Northwest Rafting Company, taking people on trips down the Rogue River. He thinks regions near the river need permanent protections because of their uniqueness and beauty.
Because of the geology, these plants have adapted to a lack of nutrients, and so there's more rare and endangered plants in these creeks, watersheds, than anywhere else in Oregon. And so if you mine these creeks, it will basically kill a lot of these plants.
Some plant species in the region are found nowhere else in the world. Collier also notes the bill's importance for outdoor recreation as a crucial part of Oregon's economy. According to the Outdoor Industry Association, statewide it supports more than $16 billion in consumer spending and 172,000 jobs a year. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A local nonprofit organization has demonstrated that it is possible to build affordable starter homes in Portland. According to a story in the Portland Tribune, the National Urban Housing and Economic Community Development Corporation was able to build 20 townhomes with prices ranging from $255,000 to $295,000. The current median selling price for a home in Portland is $410,000. The homes are designed for families and range in size from 1,200 to 1,450 square feet. They feature 3 bedrooms and 2.5 baths. The homes are available for sale to anyone, but extra incentives are available for families whose earnings are below the median income. Development Corporation Assistance Director Dalton Shepard noted that they are working with the Portland Housing Center and pointed out that there were $20,000 neighborhood lift down payment assistance grants available for qualifying families. The development is located in Northeast Portland, and Brunswick Commons will be holding open houses on Saturday, December 14th from 1 to 4 p.m. For more information, go to www.brunswickcommons.com or call 503-477-7387.
Water pumping facilities could be the key to the Pacific Northwest's renewable energy future. Pumped hydro storage can be used to store energy from renewable sources like wind and solar. Eric Tegelhoff has more on what role pumped hydro could play in our future.
As the Pacific Northwest eyes using more renewable energy, one big question arises. How will it be stored? New research from the firm Energy and Environmental Economics finds the region's current storage capacity could fall short by 10,000 megawatts by 2030. One solution could be pumped hydro storage facilities, which are made up of upper and lower reservoirs. Sources like wind and solar pump water to the upper reservoir, creating stored potential energy. Eric Steinle with Rye Development says when users need energy, but the wind stops blowing or the sun isn't shining, it is released into the lower reservoir.
If we're not going to rely on fossil fuels for energy resources, then we're going to need storage. And in terms of storage, the Pacific Northwest is blessed with geology and geography to support what is the oldest and most widely used form of energy storage in the world.
Rye Development has proposed a 394-megawatt facility near Klamath Falls that could power 400,000 homes when running at full capacity. But these facilities do have some drawbacks. They require large upfront costs and take 3 to 4 years to build. Steinle says pumped hydro facilities could last as long as 100 years, which could make them cost-effective for ratepayers in the long term. Another option with storage potential is the lithium-ion battery. But Steinle notes pumped hydro has a lower carbon footprint than lithium.
Lithium-ion has a fairly complex supply chain, relies a lot on mining, and we don't have, of course, a domestic source of lithium. We'd be looking at long-term sourcing elsewhere in the globe.
Steinle says an array of different storage methods is needed, especially as the state has to work to meet potential shortages soon. but he believes pumped hydro will be a big part of the long-term storage plans.
It's going to be a vital component, and I think you'll see a number of these projects show up in the next decade or so as we move towards meeting our 100% clean electricity goals by 2050.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali, then at 7, The Struggle. Tonight's weather will be rain showers with a low of 40. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy with a high of 46 degrees. Today in history, in 1795, a meteorite fell on the town of Wold Newton in Yorkshire, England. It was around a yard across and would later be displayed across the UK. The fall of the meteorite and the evidence gleaned from it contributed to the debate of whether extraterrestrial matter existed or not. The quote of the day is from Dick Van Dyke, who turns 94 today. He said, quote, "Just knowing you don't have the answers is a recipe for humility, openness, acceptance, forgiveness, and an eagerness to learn. And those are all good things."
Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden has announced his support for the renegotiated North American Free Trade Agreement known as NAFTA. He made the announcement in a joint statement with Ohio Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown. Wyden pointed out that he had long had concerns with the inability to confirm that Mexico and Canada were living up to their side of the original agreement. But in his statement, Wyden said that the new agreement, quote, "establishes the strongest enforcement of labor standards ever written into a U.S. trade agreement," end quote. He went on to say, "by ensuring that Mexican workers' rights are protected, we level the playing field for workers in Oregon, Ohio, and across the country." The new agreement, which is officially titled the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA, has been endorsed by both Democrats and Republicans, as well as the AFL-CIO, the largest federation of labor unions in the United States. To make it more palatable for progressive Democrats, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced a series of last-minute changes on Tuesday that included stronger provisions on labor enforcement and pharmaceuticals. It also protects export markets and opens up the Canadian dairy market to U.S. farmers. The House is expected to vote on the measure next week. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that he will not schedule a vote on the USMCA until Trump's impeachment trial is concluded.
Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee have approved two articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump, setting the stage for a House floor vote next week. The president is charged with high crimes and misdemeanors, specifically with abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The articles were passed on party lines, with 23 Democrats voting in favor of the articles and a full House vote, while all 17 Republican members voted against. It is alleged that the president attempted to withhold foreign aid from Ukraine in order to pressure its president into investigating his political rival, Joe Biden, and his son. That is the abuse of power charge, and the obstruction charge comes from the White House's refusal to cooperate with the impeachment investigation by blocking key witnesses from testifying. The House vote next week is expected to pass the articles of impeachment, which would make President Trump the third ever president to be successfully impeached in U.S. history. After that vote, however, the Senate must vote to convict in order to remove Trump from office. The Senate is Republican-controlled, and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has all but guaranteed an acquittal, vowing, quote, "total coordination with the White House on the trial."
Prescription drug prices are one major issue for voters in the 2020 election. The House passed a bill yesterday that would rein in rapidly rising drug prices. Lily Bulkley has more on the story and others with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
We have a government that works fabulously, wonderfully, for giant drug companies. It's just not working for people who are trying to get a prescription filled.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren on one of voters' top issues, the cost of prescription drugs. Yesterday, the House passed a bill aimed at reining in drug prices. The vote was along party lines, and President Trump said he would veto it if it came across his desk. But it lays out one piece of what candidates for the Democratic nomination want. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign is on the upswing. He's surpassing Warren in many polls and catching up to former Vice President Joe Biden. He also scored an endorsement from the Center for Popular Democracy Action, a coalition of progressive groups with 600,000-plus members. Jennifer Epps Addison is its president.
It felt important to tell the Democratic Party that Bernie Sanders' ideas are not fringe or left or radical.
Sanders focuses a lot on courting young voters, a group with historically low turnout. In the 2016 election, just about half of eligible voters age 18 to 29 voted, compared to more than 70% age 65 and up, according to the Census Bureau.
In 2018, we saw a significant uptick in the percentage of young people who were voting, and that made a difference in many elections around the country. But if people under 35 voted at the same percentage as people over 65, we could transform this country.
A national poll this week by Quinnipiac University had Sanders at 52% among under 35 Democrats. Barack Obama in 2008 was also popular among young people, winning two-thirds of the under 30 general election vote. Last cycle, though, Hillary Clinton didn't win the same enthusiasm.
The younger generation, it turns out, is the most progressive generation in the history of our country.
Entrepreneur Andrew Yang also gets support from younger voters. He said people call him the, quote, internet candidate and learn about him through internet memes. He joined Iowa congressional candidate J.D. Scholten for a basketball game yesterday. Scholten's running in Iowa's 4th congressional district against longtime incumbent Republican Steve King, who frequently makes headlines for controversial comments, like suggesting the world population depends on rape and incest to survive.
Now, happily, it was supposed to be one-on-one JD against me, but we wised up to the fact that watching JD blast me would not be very interesting for anybody. And so then me and JD teamed up, just like we're going to team up to beat Steve King and beat Donald Trump and solve the problems that we see here in Iowa.
But they lost 21-23 against the other team of Ames residents. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
A Washington State Supreme Court decision on releasing public employees' information has raised concerns, particularly for survivors of domestic violence. Because of these safety concerns, public employees are pushing to protect personal information. Eric Tegahoff has the story.
A lot of information can be gleaned from a birth date. That's why Washington State public employees are raising safety concerns about a recent state Supreme Court decision and hope lawmakers will correct it. In October, justices sided with the Freedom Foundation that public employees' birth dates can be disclosed under the State Public Records Act. Katie Thompson with the Employment Security Department believes this could put state workers in danger, especially those who are domestic violence survivors. Thompson reads a statement she received from an anonymous public employee and survivor of domestic abuse, who says the decision puts her life in danger.
It is so easy for my ex-husband to search databases and extract information that I would guess he will know where I am within a week. He will know exactly where I am. He will be able to walk into the lobby and see me calling a client. He can wait for me to walk to my car in the parking lot.
Public employee unions, including the Washington State Federation of Employees, want lawmakers to pass House Bill 1888 in 2020. It would help protect workers' identities and inform them if a request is made for their information. The Washington Coalition for Open Government, which includes the Seattle Times, says the Supreme Court decision was a victory for transparency and will help in media investigations. In the dissenting opinion, Justice Charles Wiggins wrote that birth dates should be exempt from disclosure, citing concerns about identity theft. Don Malo shares this concern as a community corrections officer for the Department of Corrections in Wenatchee. He also is worried because his job puts him in a vulnerable position.
I would prefer my personal information not be released to the public or make it accessible to the public, especially to people that I supervise and have made threats towards my life and my family in the past.
Administrative assistant for the Community Colleges of Spokane, Brenda Martinson, thinks the law needs to be updated to better protect public employees.
Open records and open government is one thing. The people, human beings, work for the state of Washington. We do the good work of this state.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegadoff.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party won an overwhelming majority in yesterday's parliamentary elections in Great Britain. Johnson's Tories captured 365 of the 650 available seats. Despite promising a tax increase on the rich, reinvestment in schools and the National Health Service, and an increase in social services, Jeremy Corbyn and the Liberals suffered the worst loss the Labour Party has seen since the 1950s. Johnson campaigned almost exclusively on the promise of getting Brexit done, and now he has a clear path to signal Britain's exit from the European Union by the January 31st deadline. Once that's done, he will have until the end of 2020 to negotiate a new trade deal with the EU. Donald Trump applauded Johnson's victory and promised a new trade agreement with the UK, but many Brits feel that they may lose their cherished National Health Service to US interests.
The Little Shell Chippewa Tribe from Montana is a Native American group without a reservation or land base. But new legislation in Congress could change that and finally bring the Little Shell people federal status. With that story and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonio Gonzalez. The U.S. House passed the National Defense Authorization Act this week, which moves forward the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians' federal recognition. Olivia Reingold reports.
Assuming the bill passes the Senate, the Little Shell will be recognized after generations of struggle, but it could take years to figure out the details. The bill guarantees a land base within these Montana counties: Blaine, Cascade, Glacier, and Hill. Tribal Chairman Gerald Gray says the next step will be to meet with the Department of Interior to see what acres are available. You don't know if it will include Hill 57?
No, I don't. I don't even know what's available there.
Hill 57 is an area a few miles west of Great Falls, Montana, that served as a nexus for the Little Shell community until the 1990s.
To be honest with you, I've never looked into it. I've never been that presumptuous to say, you know, we're going to be here or nothing like that.
Other things to be determined include how much federal funding the tribe will receive for education, health care, and economic development. A Department of Interior spokesperson says that depends on how many tribal members it has. For reference, a tribe with less than 3,000 members usually gets $320,000. The Little Shell Tribe has 5,400 members. The defense bill is expected to pass before the congressional session ends next week. And assuming it does, the tribe will have a year before funding kicks in. It can request supplemental funding from the Bureau of Indian Affairs before then, but the spokesperson says there are no guarantees. President Donald Trump says he'll sign the bill immediately, as soon as it reaches his desk. Then the Little Shell will no longer be one of the more than 400 unrecognized tribes in the U.S. For National Native News, I'm Olivia Reingold.
The former president of the Northern Cheyenne Tribe in Montana was sentenced Thursday to 6 months in federal prison for fraud. Lawrence Kilsback was sentenced for a reimbursement scheme involving state, tribal, and federal agencies paying him thousands of dollars for fraudulent travel expenses. Prosecutors say during his tenure as president and previously as the tribe's health director, Kilsback double-dipped and sometimes triple-dipped travel expenses, filing them across multiple agencies. In July, he pleaded guilty to wire fraud and false claims conspiracy. His sentence includes a more than $25,000 fine. A federal investigation is underway of a Michigan school district accused of maintaining a racially hostile education environment. The ACLU of Michigan filed a complaint in January with the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, asking for an investigation of Papa Public Schools. Written complaints from students of color from 2015 to 2017 allege harassment and being called racial slurs. The investigation, which began this month, includes Native American students and a controversial high school Indian mascot. The district previously denied the allegations. In a statement to local news M Live, the district said it's aware of the investigation and is cooperating. The organization Four Directions and Nevada Tribes are hosting a second Native American Presidential Forum. They're inviting all candidates running for U.S. president to join tribal leaders, elders, and young people in Las Vegas in January. The forum will focus on Native American issues in seven states: Arizona, Colorado, Michigan, Minnesota, Nevada, North Carolina, and Wisconsin. The first forum was held in August in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Portland-based ice cream chain Salt and Straw has gotten a new investor, former wrestler-turned-actor Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Johnson and his business partner, Danny Garcia of Garcia Companies and TGC Management, invested in the chain, which now has 19 locations on the West Coast. Garcia said of the investment, quote, "Salt and Straw's proven commitment to connecting with local communities through their storytelling and creativity make the strategic investment a natural fit," end quote. Previous brand relationships to The Rock include Under Armour, Voss Water, and the Athleticon Conference. So this involvement is a departure from Johnson's typical athletic endorsements. But according to his Instagram, Salt and Straw ice cream is a regular part of cheat day for Johnson, and now he will be getting his own devoted flavor. To celebrate the partnership, Salt and Straw is launching a special flavor inspired by Johnson's Dwanta Claus character.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 13th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Ray Bodwell, and special thanks to Eric Tegahoff and Lily Bulkley. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell, and the director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterland.
And I'm Clara Shadow. Coming up next is Rising Up with Sonali. Counterspin.